Okay, welcome to episode 5 of Talking with the Hippies. And in this episode, I chat with Steve Bentley, the author of a book called Undercover, which is about the time he spent an undercover cop in the early 70s. Fascinating stuff. I hope you enjoy it. Okay, Steve, thank you so much for agreeing to do this podcast with us, or with me. It's a pleasure to have you here. I read your book, which I thought was actually really good. I want to talk to you about my experiences of that in a minute. But anyway, hello, Steve. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. And thanks for having me. And thanks for the kind words, too. I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
Yeah, what I found really interesting about that book, Steve, and bear in mind at the time, well, not at the time you wrote it, but you managed to write it in a way where you took us back to how you were feeling when you, at the time you were there, which was nice. And of course, you were a cop and I was a hippie. And I still am, as you probably know. And so I took an instant dislike to you, really, when I started reading the book.
Good.
As I went through the book, I began to like you more and more. And by the end of the book, I actually was thinking, I'd really like to meet this guy. He sounds quite interesting. I hope I'm not going to lose too many friends by admitting I actually like you, Steve. But anyway, let's see where we go today.
Yeah, sure. It's very kind of you to say so, because I think one of the overall things that came out of the book or the reaction to the book in general was the feeling that people got that they were that I was totally open and honest in the book, which I believe to this day that I was. I was very honest and open about my own feelings, and despite the fact that I was a cop, I think I've always been a fairly likable guy, even though I was a cop at one time. But anyway, sorry, carry on.
But you started off in the local, on the local drug scene, and you were basically one of the guys. And I remember guys like you who would, there would be rumors he's in the drug squad and da 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 da. And so to me at that point, you were just annoying, really. And it's just like, how could anyone do that?
Be honest, back in those days, the local people that we were after, harassed or whatever way you want to put it, they used to refer to us as pigs, and which was, that was quite common back in the 70s, as you know. So I probably took offense at that then, but the fact that we were called pigs, looking back on it, doesn't offend me now. You know, it's just part of the scene. But that part of the book, you know, I was trying to get over that I actually hated that local scene. When I was on the drug squad in Northern Hampshire, you know, operating in areas like Basingstoke, Aldershot, Farnborough, Andover, places like that, and occasionally had to wander down to Southampton or Pompey for various reasons. You know, I hated that scene. I really detested it because I think I used a phrase about people getting excited about finding a few roaches in an ashtray. And I'm serious. People did get excited, you know, getting a misuse of drugs warrant and going in and busting a place, you know, and getting all excited about a few roaches or a few tablets of speed, you know, and or a couple of grams or a half a gram of speed or something like that, you know. And it was, I thought, what is this? I couldn't be doing with it. It wasn't my scene at all, Tom. You know, and people who haven't read the book, they will know that my background before that, before the drug squad in Hampshire, was I was a detective on Merseyside. Well, you know, that was a completely different scene completely. You know, I was dealing with hardcore criminals, proper crime, when I was based on Merseyside. And then for various personal reasons, I transferred to Hampshire and, ended up trying to get back in plain clothes as quickly as possible. and some clown in headquarters decided to stick me on the drug squad. But I hated it. And that's when I got the phone call from Dick Lee, who was then Thames Valley, head of drug squad in Thames Valley. I'd met Dick on a few joint bus up in Northern Hampshire, Southern Berkshire. And, you know, Dick called me and started telling me about this. He didn't call it Operation Julie, but he started telling me about this multi-force operation and the acid thing and da-da-da-da-da-da. Did I want to be part of it? So as a stupid 29-year-old, and it sounded like a bit of an adrenaline kick, I went, yeah, okay.
Well, to be honest, Steve, you had a nice time, really. I mean, I can imagine there's all kind of conflicts going on inside of you. Well, you admit that anyway, don't you?
Yeah, of course there were conflicts, but yeah.
I mean, I don't want to spend too long on Operation Julie as such, because I've got so much other stuff I want to get through. But
okay.
But you met people on the scene that you, well, I don't know if you use the word infiltrated, as an undercover cop. I guess it is infiltrated, really, because you go into great detail of how you did it. And you met people on the scene there that you became very fond of. And
that's true.
At one point, there's even a point in the book where, I don't want to spoil the book for anyone who wants to read it, really, but it's quite powerful.
It's powerful and very true. I mean, it's funny when you say on the scene, I was kind of on the scene, yet I wasn't on the scene. Let me try and explain that, because your podcast is got the word hippie in the title. Now, the scene that I was really infiltrating wasn't really the hippie scene per se. Yes, I met hippies and went to Sid Wall's place with the teepees and all the rest of it, and went to a festival in the Elan Valley for the day, and went to a wonderful day out at a village hall in Pontryfendigai. I think I've got pronounced that correctly, where performance was being played, and the whole village hall was full of heads, as I call them in the book, and called them in that day, you know, back in that day. And it was full of heads. I mean, what I call proper hippies. And but the people that I was mainly associating with, I wouldn't classify them as hippies. And I don't want to spoil anything that you may want to ask. But I mean, for example, Smiles and his pal Buzz, I wouldn't classify those two as hippies. They didn't dress like hippies. They didn't act like hippies. There were certain characteristics, you could say, of, you know, the hippie culture or the hippie trail. I mean, Smiles was always talking about buying a secondhand VW and going abroad. You know, I was reading between the lines thinking, well, I know why he wants the VW camper. He wants to bring some hash back, but the point I'm making is that the main people that Eric, my undercover partner, and I associated with, I wouldn't really classify them as hippies, with possibly one exception, the character called Blue. And I would say that he fitted more the characteristic hippie type than certainly Smiles and his pal Buzz.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because obviously the kind of hippie, the word hippie was a very broad genre in a way, in that there were all sorts. Yeah. For example, me, I was much more drawn towards self-sufficiency and that kind of stuff. And so yes. When I think of hippie, I think of that area. But there were also the businessmen and the fixers and the organisers and the people in the media who were doing the magazines. I mean, there was a broad section of society involved in that movement.
And
having read some of the stuff and watched some videos and so on, you know, there's stuff on the internet about Smiles. I've never met him, but he seems like a nice guy, you know. I can imagine that, you know, if I'd have met him at that time, I wouldn't have thought twice about including him in the sort of umbrella word of hippie. I understand what you're saying. Sorry.
Yeah, that's right. No, that's right. You're absolutely right. I mean, he was a nice guy. I mean, I got on really well with him and actually felt quite close to him, as you well know, because you've read the book. And I won't go into any spoilers for anybody who wants to read the book, but I did get very close to him as a person. I liked him immensely. There we are.
I think, I mean, this is a question that I've got way down my list here, is, I mean, I think that is what almost a loose end that you feel never really got sorted out, was your relationship with Smiles. I mean, obviously it was a tricky one for you to fix, really, because he ended up going to jail for all that time. He was obviously, I imagine, a bit peed off about that.
We've kind of had brief dialogue conversations on Facebook. Oh, not for a long time now, but when was my Julie book first published? 2016, 2017. So I would say in the around about that time, around about 2017, there were various exchanges on Facebook between Smiles and I, and he wasn't bitter at all. I took the piss a little bit, which is fine. You know, there was always this big thing between us since, from the time I'm talking about, from 2017 onwards, there's always been this big thing between us that he stated to all and sundry that, of course, he knew from day one that we were undercover cops. And my thoughts are well recorded in the book, so I'm not going to trot them all out all over again unless you particularly want to ask me about that. But I don't think he did. He suspected without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, this is a man dealing for a living in the rural Wales, and anybody that comes into that area, very rural area, strangers, he's going to be very suspicious. He was suspicious without a shadow of a doubt, and he challenged us on more than one occasion. And but at the end of the day, I think the thing that really persuaded him that maybe he was wrong was we had a very drunken night in a pub in Tregaron one night, where I threatened to stick the local policeman's truncheon where the sun doesn't shine, and used a lot of bad language, and we ran off, disappeared with Scarford, Smiles, Eric, my undercover buddy.
I mean, stunning, really.
One other guy who was a local, and that's we ran to the local's house, and we hid in darkness until PC Lake had disappeared. And it was at that time when we thought the copper had gone, and he had gone, and we put the lights back on, and Smiles just laughed. He laughed and looked at me straight in the face, and he went, "Cop killer." That was my nickname from that day onwards until we left. So, and the other material thing where I throw doubt on what Smiles says about his knowledge was that shortly before we left, he actually talked to me about trying to score fairly substantial amounts of cocaine from me and Eric, because he knew about a trip that we'd done to Liverpool and met these gangsters up there that were involved in a cocaine importation thing. So, you know, I let the reader make their own judgment, and whether it's right what he's saying or whether it's right what I'm saying. Suspected us? Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt, he suspected us. But I think we managed to pull it off. That's my version, and I'm sticking to it.
and the other guy that you plays quite a big part in your book is Blue, and it turns out he has nothing to do with either supplying or manufacturing LSD. He was just hanging out. Is that
he had nothing to do with supplying and manufacturing LSD. There's a lot of murky background with Blue, and I don't know what the I've not been able to penetrate that murky background. But he's another one that popped up out of the blue on Facebook, and we started conversing via messaging and this, that, and the other. And we got on fine. And but he's very cryptic. He talks in riddles, does Blue. And after a few weeks of these riddles going backwards and forwards, I gave up in the end. I said, Blue, this isn't working, you know, so, you know, let's call it a day. But he kept dropping hints about what he was up to in that neck of the woods and how Eric and I would have been shocked to find out what was in the piano that we moved one day to his home. You know, therefore implying that, you know, there was a couple of weights of dope in there of one kind or another. You know, that is Blue. I don't know. I mean, I read something about Smiles. Smiles was saying that he suspected that Blue was an undercover agent for customs, not the police, but an undercover agent for British customs. I don't know. I'm not saying
anything. That's interesting, because in the book, two things. Firstly, I'm going to say that scene with the piano that you write, utterly brilliant bit of writing. And I don't hand out praise, you know, easily, but that I was laughing. And, you know, I could totally, but, you know, that kind of scene, I hope I'm not going to forget my second point here, but that kind of scene, and also the scene where you are really rude to the local constable and Copper. Then all go running yeah. out. I mean, those kind of scenes, I can imagine the bond between you and the your supposed whatever, not enemies really, but the people you're supposed to be working against, really.
Yeah,
I would have been
yeah, that's
honest.
Right. Yeah,
I would have
that's,
just been like, well, these guys are my mates.
Well, you know, that's it. I mean, you know, whatever the level of suspicion that Smiles had, I do really sincerely think that he thought of me in particular as a, not quite as a friend, but somebody that he could be friendly with. And, you know, and I felt the same way. And yeah, so interesting days.
I think it's really nice when, you know, I mean, obviously there's the rather unfortunate problem of them, those guys having to spend a lot of time in jail. But I can imagine, you know, that although when I was young freak, I used to try and be friends to the coppers, and they didn't really understand what was going on. So they couldn't really come onto our wavelength. Whereas you, by going undercover for that amount of time, you clearly did get that understanding of where we were coming from to a degree. And so that some real communication could happen.
To a degree, that's right. I'm not saying, I'll give you an example. When I went to Elam Valley and when I went to the teepees, Sid Rawls's place with the teepees, I could accept it, but I couldn't understand it because it was a different kind of lifestyle than I had ever encountered. And but I wasn't dismissive. I found it actually quite interesting. And really, a lot of the hippie movement, even back in the days that I'm talking about in the 1970s, I remember visiting a place just outside of Maconmouth in Wales, and it was an alternative energy centre with windmills and all kinds of things. You know, I mean, you know, my goodness, Tom, you know, they were light years ahead of what's happening now. You know, so, you know, the trouble with society is, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, and I'm a child of the 60s, back in the 60s and the 70s, you know, the tabloid press and even the, you know, the likes of the Times and the Guardian and the Telegraph, they didn't understand alternative society at all. And, you know, the alternative society viewpoint
perspective was not put across, was not publicized in any widespread fashion. So, you know, let's use LSD as an example. You know, the tabloids still in the 70s were still full of stories of LSD, people on LSD trips, diving off skyscrapers and killing themselves, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I researched a lot for my book, and I have never been able to find one particular instance, one particular piece of evidence where LSD was the contributor to a death. There may well be circumstances where somebody had, let's say, for example, mental health problems and had a bad trip and something happened to them and maybe they died or whatever. But the tabloid press, you know, made it out that it was this demon drug, and you know it was that was shouted from the highest buildings, you know, to mix metaphors terribly and badly. But you know, that was the atmosphere that was around when Operation Julie Police Squad was formed. So you know, acid was bad and da 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 da. You know, and don't get me wrong, anybody listening to this podcast, I'm not advocating that you should go out and try acid or any drug for that matter. It's a very personal choice, because there are risks, in my opinion, there can be risks associated with drug taking. You know, so I'm neither preaching for or against drugs. It's a very independent, it's a very personal choice. As to whether you try them or take them or whatever. So I'm just trying to explain the background as to, you know, the way things were back in the 70s. I mean, when I was first approached about Operation Julie, I'm thinking, oh, shit, you know, I'm going to mingle with all these hippies. I haven't got a clue what all that's about. So I actually, my training, self-training, was I went and bought that Carlos Castaneda book, Teachings of the Yaqui Indian. You know, at least it gave me just some insight into hallucinogenics, you know, and gave me something to talk about with Smiles as well. We were able to discuss that book. So yeah, you know, you know, that's kind of giving you the and the listeners the background to what was going on generally back in the 70s at the time of Operation Julie, and before, of course.
Absolutely. I'm with you on a lot of what you've said there, Steve. I'd just go into that thing about the mainstream society not being able to understand the alternative culture, and how that links in with something that a lot of people in the alternative culture felt quite aggrieved about, was the way more energy was put into smashing up the LSD ring and the the psychedelic scene, which was a very strong part of our, I mean, again, like you, I'm not advocating anyone takes drugs. I totally agree with what you say. It's a very personal thing that people must make their own mind up about, and I'm not saying it's bad or anything. But at that time, it was almost the basis of the hippie culture in a way. I mean, love and peace was the basis, but the psychedelic thing, we believed at that time, allowed us to kind of see a bit more of how we were all part of one thing.
No, that's right. I understand that, and but that's an understanding that's only come to me as I've got older. At that particular time, in that era when I was operating, for want of a better word, that wasn't an understanding that I had, and many others like me didn't have. And therefore, it's understandable why the scene, for want of a better expression, thought that the police were pigs and were repressive and part of a state machinery and blah, 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 blah. I can understand that now. I can understand it. And I've been able to understand that for a long time now, not just now that I'm speaking to you. But yeah, I can understand it. And also, that's another slight byproduct or aside at the end of Operation Julie. If you recall, I said in my book that one of Smiles's associates said to me, you know, it's a shame that you don't now concentrate on heroin that's starting to come into this country. And that man's words were prophetic, because at that stage, we didn't have a clue about this cheap heroin that was starting to flood into the country and created the sink estates, which then burgeoned into crime to feed a heroin habit. And then a bit later, you had the crack cocaine problem as well, alongside heroin. And therefore, then you've got the real start of the war on drugs, because those commodities, heroin and crack cocaine, they involve violent gangs. Nothing like the Operation Julie people. You know, they were in the main, they were peace-loving people and peaceable people, you know, peaceful people. So what happened afterwards, and the prophetic words of that particular individual who forecast what was going to happen. You know, and that's why Dick Lee, bless him, he had faults, but he had a lot of good points. Dick Lee was trying to convince the powers that be to form a national drug squad based on the Operation Julie squad to tackle the heroin and cocaine, probably in a realization that LSD, acid, and psychedelics weren't the real problem. Although then we come forward many, many, many years, and you've got all these synthetic hallucinogenics, and LSD is synthetic, you know that, and I know that, but you've got all these designers type, the Chinese manufactured synthetics that come over, and that you know, the government's had to react all the time by outlawing one particular product after another, you know, because you know the bad guys, they keep, you know, finding a way to make something legal, at least on a temporary basis. Yeah. So it's quite a mad scene, really. I'm glad I'm out of it now. I mean, it's the days we were around, the days that you experienced, and the days that I experienced. Really, we were babies, you know, compared to what goes on now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it is interesting that you see sort of equivalence in a way of the hippie scene with the new age, you know, the new age travelers, say, and
I do.
You know, they're people with the same ideas and the same heart, just thinking, hang on a minute, something's not quite right here, there must be a better way to live. And I think that in a way that's makes me a little bit sad, that there's such innocence on our part, really.
Yeah.
You know, you look at society, and surely anyone can see it. I know, certainly know you can, that something's not quite right. And then we come up with this idea of, look, perhaps we can do this a little bit better, and it just gets smashed to pieces, and it's a little bit disappointing. But anyway, go on like that forever. I want to take you back to this this bit you were talking about with Blue, and because in your book, I may have read this wrongly, but you at the end you go, where are they now and stuff, and it's fascinating, and you're like, yeah, I can't wait, where's so-and-so and with Blue you don't give anything away, because he just suddenly disappeared, didn't he? You know, he somehow managed to just disappear. I don't know if he got caught up in the bust or what, but
no, my understanding is that he disappeared just before the bus happened,
right? And then in your book you kind of use it slightly as a hook for your next book, which have I read that right? And I thought, well,
yeah you're right, it goes back to what I was saying about where I'd read somewhere that Smiles also, or Smiles, should I say, believed that Blue could have been a customs undercover agent. And where this goes back to, after I left the police force and Dick Lee had left the police force, I met Dick Lee in Scarborough, where he lived. And we had Sunday lunch that his gracious wife had cooked for me. And chatting to Dick after the Sunday lunch over a malt whiskey or three, and I said to Dick, I said, what's the score with blue? I said, that's something I've never been able to figure out. So Dick Lee said something like, well, what do you mean? I said, well, I've got this theory. He said, well, you better roll it out then, Bentley, as he used to call me. You better roll it out. And I said, well, I sometimes wonder whether he wasn't a plant, that he was kind of undercover himself. And Dick Lee rolled about laughing. And then he said, no, you got that completely wrong. Him and the Canadian, Bill, he said, were dealt with by the DEA and ended up serving many, many years in a state penitentiary. And that's what Dick Lee told me. But there's something always niggled me about what Dick Lee had said, because he was a big bullshitter as well, was Dick, you know, and always niggled me of whether that was truthful. And I got this thing in my head about the next book, a fiction book, kind of a spin-off from Operation Julie. So it was making Blue and Bill two fictional characters who were actually, now I can't remember, it's that long ago since I wrote it, but Bill turned out to be mafia, but he was also working for customs. Oh, that's it, it's coming back to me now. And Blue was an undercover customs agent. Now, I stress at this point when I'm talking about this that that is fiction, that I put it in a fiction book, but it was definitely a spin-off from my wanderings, my musings about who the hell Blue and Bill really were. You know, these were the two people that we met in Canada on this, in Liverpool on this cocaine thing, you know. So I don't know. I'll never get to the truth. I try to bottom it with Blue while I actually converse with him on Facebook Messenger, but he was just going around in riddles, you know, and around in circles and riddles, and you know, there's a lot you don't know, Steve, and blah 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 blah. And you know, in the end, I just gave up. You know, I thought, well, he's not going to tell me anyway. So there we are.
Yeah, that was. Rather wild ending to that scene, wasn't it, with all that big massive coke deal and all that kind of thing, a bit of a distraction. Nothing really to do with Operation Julie, but interesting nevertheless.
It was nothing to do with Operation Julie, you're quite right, and as you know, having read the book, that was one of Dick Lee's dilemma. That on paper it sounded like a very worthwhile big bust, and but on the other hand, it distracted him from the aims and objectives of Operation Julie. So in the end, his missive was just keep stringing along Bill and Blue, and that's what we did, and that's when we borrowed that. I think it was about 13 kilos of very dried up cannabis from a Bristol drugstore. Police station, drugstore, and showed it to subtly showed it to Blue on one of our trips up there in that transit van, and that's when I wrote, got him hook, line, and sinker. You know, I think Blue accepted that. You know, we were in the game, unless of course he was an undercover agent and was being told that who we really were. But that's what working undercover gets you, like Tom. You know, you start getting paranoia.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
A bit like living in East Germany in the sort of 60s and 70s, where you don't know who's on whose side here.
Exactly. I mean, that was one of the things that you always thought, you know, no matter where I went, it was always a case of, you know, who is he, who is she? You know, you're always wondering who the hell it was, you know. And you know, and even though I say, you know, the whole acid scene was very peaceful and I didn't see any violence, unless it was me that started it with a cop in the village. You know, but, you know, that was with the benefit of hindsight. Most of that is with the benefit of hindsight. At that particular time, knowing I was undercover, living under a false identity, I hadn't got a clue how somebody would react if they really found out who I was. You know, I didn't know that, you know, they were going to be peaceable people, and that the chances of them giving me a good hiding, or worse, were fairly remote, because at the time I just didn't know that. But anyway, there we are.
It's quite unusual, isn't it? That, I mean, in a lot of, well, my experiences, limited though they were, because I didn't take drugs seriously for that many years, but yeah, we had quite a strong rule that we didn't go anywhere near any of the big boys, because, you know, of that whole, the criminal thing that would scare us.
Yeah.
But with that particular psychedelic scene, of what I've read about it, it would be interesting if they had have found out who you were, because they were really quite peace-loving people, weren't they? There weren't really any serious criminals there. There were some people in it involved who were in it to make big bucks. There were.
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt, there were a number of people, especially at the towards the top of the chamber, that were in it to make big bucks. But whether they were violent people or not, you know, is extremely doubtful. You know, I think the only person that could have resorted to violence, and I met him, was the guy that was in charge of the LSD lab at Seymour Road in London, and Henry Todd. And I think Henry, I don't think Henry would have been averse to using a bit of violence. You know, I think on the night that I went in there with all the other officers, I think if it had just been one or two of us, I think he might have swung a punch or two. But seeing that he was vastly outnumbered, and it, you know, it was a very well organized bust, you know, he just glared at everybody, and there was no violence. But I didn't see any violence, as I say, didn't see any at all. I think there was more chance of meeting a violent end if we'd have rubbed up some of the Free Wales Army people the wrong way. And, because one of them lived very close to Smiles, and Smiles knew him very well. I'm given to understand that I actually met him on one occasion, but I can't remember meeting the guy. But apparently he was given to a little bit of some violent tendencies. So, you know, anyway, we didn't have a problem in that respect.
Let's just chat a bit, tiny bit about the guy right at the top of the tree here. As far as I understand it, the guy that really was the key to the production of the acid was a guy called Richard Kemp. And I know you weren't specifically watching him, or I think you weren't specifically watching him, or had any involvement with him, but I've read a bit about him, and he was an extremely idealistic bloke, from what I've read.
I think that's right. And I must correct you on one thing. Very early on, in fact, my first assignment on Operation Julie wasn't undercover, but I was on a surveillance team. We were watching that the big house, the mansion, Place Lissin at Carnot, and that was where Kemp was actually manufacturing acid. He was just cleaning up as we arrived. And we watched him clean up, and we watched him leave, and that's where he was with Arnabaldi, the American. And I did see him, but I never met him. I saw him through binoculars and a camera lens and photographed him many times, but I never met him. But it's right what you say. He seems to have been an idealist. I mean, I read that 53-page statement, voluntary statement that he made, when he was on remand awaiting sentence. And I think that gives an insight into the man's ideals. And he's still alive, I'm told. He disappeared for a long time. Nobody had heard a thing about him. And I'm told on good authority that he's still alive. In fact, he was asked to cooperate with a proposed Operation Julie documentary, but he ummed and ahed and wouldn't say yes. So the making of that documentary recently folded. That was fairly recently. There was going to be a three-part Operation Julie documentary telling the story right from the early days in Cambridge, and David Solomon, the American, Richard Kemp, and probably the shadowy figure of Richard Stark, Ronald Stark rather, may have got a mention at that particular stage. And the chem manufacturing the acid in Paris before he came back to England, started manufacturing Liverpool first of all, and then by all accounts he stuck a pin in the map and came up with Mid Wales. And Arnaboldi, the other American by this time, had come on the scene, and he was the front man. In fact, he may have actually financed the purchase of Glasslessin in Carno in Mid Wales. And he was there on the pretext that he was writing an autobiography of JFK. So that's, you know, they started manufacturing there. But I think that was going to be his last run at that particular place, because it was clear after the bust that they were setting up to manufacture close to where the cottage was, in a little bit further away, just outside of Tregaron. So, yeah, a very interesting man, very idealistic. Other than that, I can't really say too much about him, Tom, because I never got to talk to him or have a conversation with him. So,
what I found interesting, Steve, is that I read some of the 50. I haven't seen the entire 53 pages. I'd love to see it, but I'll just for the listeners, I'll explain that when Richard Kemp was on remand and he wrote a 53 page statement to give to the judge to explain that he wasn't an evil man. That's as I understand it.
And, yeah, basically, that's right, yeah.
And some of what he wrote, I mean, it's recorded in one of the many books about Operation Julie, which I'm going to talk to you about in a minute, Steve. But some of what he wrote was mind-blowing. And it's absolutely true of what a lot of us were feeling at that time, was that the way that the human race was behaving on planet Earth was unsustainable. And we needed to change the way we lived, actually make changes to the way we lived, and we needed to change our value systems. Mm-hmm. And his idea was, and I understand this because to a degree it was my idea when I first took hallucinogenic drugs, but I kind of worked out it was going to take a bit more than that to do this. His idea was that we would need to somehow change the consciousness of the people to get them to understand that materialism isn't what, you know, makes you happy. Yeah. Now, this is like music to my ears, then and now, to be honest, Steve. And the only difference I have, of course, is that at the time he thought he could, you know, hallucinogenic drugs was going to be the thing that would do it. Well, I do think later, perhaps, well, I do know, actually, because I think he says it in the statement, he kind of has come to a point where he realizes that isn't the case for everybody. It isn't like an automatic thing.
Yeah, true. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, he's
so it was a very idealistic situation that he was in. I mean, akin to Timothy Leary and all those guys who were just who, when they first took acid, just thought this is the answer to man's problems. I think as time goes by, you realise, of course, it's not. Of course, or maybe you don't.
I think those were his initial. I think that was his initial motivation, that he kind of wanted to see a better world. But I think as time went by, I think the motivation changed when he and the others saw the money coming in on a regular basis. So I'm not saying that it was all about the money with him, because I don't think it was. But I think the money aspect of things changed his outlook quite markedly. But the difficulty is there's only Richard Kemp can speak about that and his frame of mind as to his state of mind. And I find it difficult really to add very much more about Richard Kemp, because, as I say, my dealings with him were extremely limited.
Yeah. Okay, let's just talk about, because we've had a long chat. It's been great. I've really enjoyed it, Steve. Tell you.
Good, no problem.
Let's just talk about the kind of cottage industry that's grown up around Operation Julie in a way. Because once you start looking into it, you realise that I find it quite fascinating, because I'm fascinated by the media and and culture and all of that stuff. And it started off, I mean, it was massive. Let's face it, it was massive. But it was hugely exaggerated by the press, in my view.
Yeah, of course.
They made far more of it than it ever. I mean, for example, when they were taking the guys from remand to the court, they had helicopters and God knows what. And, you know, we're talking about 15 hippies. But maybe not 15 hippies, maybe 30.
You're right. I agree. I mean, there wasn't a lot of hype, but it was massive at the same time. I mean, in my lifetime, I've never known a regular news bulletin, which I think was about 20 minutes or maybe 30 minutes at that particular time, 77, the bus, there was a big burst of media activity. And again in 78 with the sentencing. But I think it was 77 when the BBC broadcast an hour-long news special. And it was 95% all about Operation Julie. It was like a mini documentary. It was unbelievable. You know, and ITV did something similar. And, you know, and as you know, if you've seen anything about the clippings from the time, you know, the Times, the Guardian, the Telegraph, and of course all the red tops, the media coverage was massive. And then again, it was almost repeated again in 78 after the sentencing. And then I came out of the police force in 1980 and minding my own business. I was living up in West Yorkshire at the time. And all of a sudden, I guess somebody has tracked me down from Radio Leeds and the Yorkshire Post. They want to talk to me about Operation Julie.
Yeah, Operation Julie. I mean, it turned into a massive thing, didn't it? Okay, Steve, so let me just ask you one last thing. I mean, I know from your book that you took, you were smoking the dope.
Yeah.
And you clearly had a psychedelic experience.
And yeah, I did.
Do you think that that those experiences have coloured perhaps the way you view life or have lived your life?
Well, in some ways, let me make it absolutely clear. I never took acid, and funny enough, going back to some of the other things I've said, that Smiles in response. I actually saw the conversation somewhere on Facebook. Smiles in response to somebody who said, "Well, why didn't you, talking about me and Eric? Why didn't you spike those guys' drinks?" And Smile said, "Don't be stupid. You know, that is not what acid all is all about. It's got to be personal choice. You've got to be in the setting. You know, you've got to, you know, if you're an acid virgin, you should really have somebody there to babysit you, etc." You know, in other words, a very responsible response from Smile. Smiles, thank you very much. And so I never used acid at all. But yeah, smokes a lot of dope. Tripped through using dope, which I didn't think was possible, but because we were using bongs and inhaling very large quantities of THC in one go, you know, and you know, the room started spinning, and I had to go out to the loo, and you know, I really tripped. You know, I was actually sick in the toilet, and there was this monster coming out, and da 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 da. And then when I calmed down, you know, went back into the game of cards and joined Smiles and the others again, you know, although I wasn't tripping as badly, you know, the cards were actually looming up at me, you know. And then I think I put in the book, when we left there and walked back to our cottage down the street, let's say the street is 35, 40 feet wide. Well, it felt like it was about 5 feet wide, and I was bouncing from wall to wall. You know, and those old stars, it was a clear night, and those old stars, you know, I could touch them. Yeah. You know, so it was, yeah, I was tripping. And that's my honest and open admissions that, yes, I smoked and I did inhale, not like a former president of the United States.
What I find fascinating, your journey is fascinating. And I hope I've captured that in the podcast. I really do, because what is interesting is obviously, and I can't, you must know, you do know this, obviously, there is animosity from the people involved towards the police. And that's inevitable, yeah. Isn't it? Bound to be.
Of course. And
yet somehow or other, having met you now, and actually from reading your book, I can tell you're an okay bloke. You know, the fact that you're a cop in a job, it's not, neither here nor there.
Thank you. It's nice of you to say that. And I think that's always been true. You know, sounds a bit big-headed, but I don't mean it that way. I think that's always been true, even when I was a younger man, because, you know, my attitude, you know, I was on CID in Merseyside at a very young age, 21 years of age, a baby. And I was on CID working with very experienced senior detectives, some of whom were cynical people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there's something in my makeup. My attitude has always been, number one, there but for the grace of God, go I. And number two, as a cop, it wasn't my job to make people angry. My job was to collect evidence, put it in front of a court, and let a court decide what to do. You know, if somebody got a six-month sentence instead of a six-year sentence, it didn't get me mad. A lot of my colleagues that used to, you know, they used to take it so personal, you know, and I've never taken anything so personal at all to do with policing or the other side, if I can call it that. So that's why I think that when I went into that village for the first time, a mix with the like of Smiles, Blue, etc., etc., my natural personality came out, and it was a case of, you know, he's actually quite likable, this guy. Which I think I am. I think I am quite likable. I can tell a story. I love a beer, da, 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 da. So I think the person that I am, it helped me in that role, even though I knew I was being deceptive, that it was full of duplicity. And that's why I felt so bad about it, particularly vis-a-vis me and Smiles, you know, because I felt really close to Smiles. And now I'm only repeating what I'm going over. But I think that, Tom, that hopefully also tries to explain that what you're talking to is a cop or an ex-cop who actually had a brain and some empathy for other humans, just being yourself and getting on with folks, you know, and that's who I am.
Interesting. I mean, you know, those qualities that you've got there, I mean, I could see how that would be an advantage in some situations as a cop, but it would be a terrible hindrance in others. You know, the empathy and so on. You know, when you look at, when you read Martin Pritchard's book and you just think, this guy's he hates these people that he's up against.
Yeah.
And you never, that doesn't come from you. I don't think once was there a reference to anyone, you know, like they were some kind of evil, from the evil empire or something. Whereas
that's absolutely right. And I was horrified. There was an ITV Wales broadcast about Operation Julie 2-3 years back, and I was horrified that but I saw Dave Redrub being interviewed. He was a DS on Operation Julie, Detective Sonia, and Dave was full of, these people are animals, they're evil, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I'm going, oh, my God, where are you coming from with all that rubbish, you know? It's just, you know, the brainwashing, unbelievable, you know. And some people, you know, and this doesn't apply just to police officers or ex-police officers, some people in life just cannot work it out for themselves, cannot see things.
You've got to say, Steve, that the forces that people are put under and the pressure people are put under, it's hardly surprising, really, that they just take on view the establishment narrative.
Well,
pretty depressing.
Well, that's absolutely true. And let's be honest, you know, the police force for many, many years, when it recruited police officers, the top of the agenda was not intelligence. It was just various other qualities, you know, and certainly wasn't intelligence, you know, and so yeah, there we go.
Excellent. Thank you, Steve. Really great to meet you and really great to chat to you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Okay, that was episode 5 of Talking with the Hippies. If you enjoyed listening to the podcast, share it, and remember to follow it to find out about new episodes coming up. And thank you so much for listening.